another survey kind of talk, which is centered around quasi-periodic localization and related aspects such as what I mentioned last time, linear Schrödinger operators with time-dependent potential, and aspects of KM theory for nonlinear PDEs. So, basically, say, general picture. So here we just look at lattice Schrödinger operators on Z with a quasi-periodic potential, an area which has taken off with work of Frölich, Spencer, Sinai, and which is now, say, certainly in the one-dimensional case, reasonably well understood, both in certainly in very specific models like that of the almost Mathieu, but also more generally when one considers at least real analytic potentials. If you go outside the context of real analytic potentials, which I will not at all discuss here, then you can definitely ask for a number of questions, which one doesn't quite know what to do with. But in the context of real analytic potentials, one has a rather coherent theory, which is, well, I mean, with results which are non-perturbative or perturbative, and to some good extent, one understands in which instances you can expect non-perturbative results and in which cases not. And I will try to make an overview of the state of knowledge here. So what I consider is a matrix, an infinite matrix. The diagonal is given by a quasi-periodic potential obtained by evaluating a non-constant real analytic potential on the orbit of a dynamical system, which here, say in that case, is simply given by a shift by omega. Now the dynamics, you see you have two dimensions there. There is a dynamic, there is a dimension of the lattice on which you are working, which is here dimension one. Later I will consider dimension two also. So it's a one-dimensional lattice, but then there is a dimension of the dynamics. So this dynamics in that case is a shift on a d-dimensional torus. So this is the diagonal. It's given by the evaluation of that potential on this orbit, and then you have off-diagonal the Laplacian mentioned to you earlier, which is the lattice Laplacian, which is zero everywhere except for nearest neighbor n prime are of distance one. You will have one, so it's one below, one above the diagonal. Now, in the one-dimensional lattice case, you have the advantage of the transfer matrix formalism, something you do not have when the lattice is higher dimensional, like, for instance, what I will discuss tomorrow. You don't have this transfer matrix formalism, but here you have it, which is quite a useful tool. So the transfer matrix is an element of SL2R, which is simply expressed as the product of the matrices lambda Vx plus n omega minus E minus 1, 1, 0. And if I give you Psi0, Psi1, you can reconstruct the whole sequence. So if you're looking at a solution of the equation H Psi equals E Psi, equivalently written in that form, well, indeed, if I give you Psi1, Psi0, Psi1, you're going to recover Psi n and Psi n plus 1 just by having this MN transfer matrix acting. One small remark is that, for instance, What is not possible is that if psi0, psi1 is not 0, is to have consecutive psin and psn plus 1s which are smaller than exponential. Because that would create you, of course, a problem, since the norm of Mn of this matrix is at most exponentially growing in n. So this is a very nice phenomenon which you have in the one-dimensional case, and say in higher dimension, this issue how small sites or families of sites can be is quite not clear, and is in fact the one of the main problems that will appear in tomorrow's talk. In any case, you have a Lyapunov exponent which is defined the usual way. This is, if you want, average Lyapunov exponent. So you just integrate the logarithm of the norm of Mn on x and you divide by n. And it relates to the density of states by the well-known Stahl's formula. Now, you see, this transform matrix is quite useful, and of course it's kind of a rigid setup, because if I would give you something slightly different from the Laplacian, it's not so clear anymore how this transform matrix would work. I will describe the things to some extent using this transform matrix and this setting, because it just happens that standard models are in that form, but somehow many of the techniques, they do extend beyond the setting of the transform matrix situation. Well, yeah. I would expect. Yes, I have not really. I'm not really 100% sure. You may have many exponents. Yeah.
And then you look at the wedge product of those matrices, and that has exponents. And there's a structure, so half a negative, half a positive. And there are many exponents.
There are many exponents.
And it's directionally dependent. I mean, it's a complicated thing. You sort of just cook up the problem. So the answer is maybe.
So what is the answer? The answer is yes. There is some
maybe,
yeah. I am not familiar with it. I couldn't answer you. Because, I mean, what has definitely been studied are regularity properties of the integrated density of states in higher dimension, without necessarily having the transform matrix formula at hand. One way to do it is to study properties of the Lyapunov exponent, and then essentially this operates like a Hilbert transform, right? Deriving properties from the integrated density of states from properties of the Lyapunov exponent. But one can try directly to understand whatever regularity, held regularity of the integrated density of states without going through this Stahl's formula. But I'm not really sure how to write the formula down. So why do I stick with, at least for part of this exposition, with this rather restricted setup? Well, there is one model that has been infinitely more studied, say, where most of the literature in some sense relates to, which is the almost mature case. And the almost mature case is for the cosine potential. It's the model for Bloch electrons in a magnetic field, has been quite popularized for the works of Pyles and Hofstadter. And like I told you, well, one has a reasonably good picture now. In particular, in that model, one has a complete spectral picture, or almost complete spectral picture, which is even more precise than what one really, I mean, this is what you call an area which has been overdeveloped, right? I mean, so in any case, there are still some things one should say that are specific to this model and certainly not generic for that kind of questions. So what is the answer? You see, when the diagonal is getting big, so when lambda is big, then, well, you expect, of course, that the spectrum has a good chance of being point spectrum. So that is, in fact, happening for lambda larger than 2. You get pure point spectrum with Anderson localization. All these statements are almost surely in X and omega. And you can make much more precise statements, but I don't care about them. Yeah, yeah. And let's just... And you can make them quite precise, and the Diophantine conditions are very modest. I mean, but let's just, for simplicity, state it in terms of the measure category. Now, what happens below? If lambda is less than 2, then you have pure, absolutely continuous spectrum. And at lambda equals to 2, you have pure, singular, continuous spectrum. So there is one interesting thing here, is that if I specify your lambda, basically, there is no coexistence of different spectral types. So either it's all points, or it's absolutely continuous, purely singular continuous spectrum. This thing is not expected, and in fact is not the generic picture for real analytic potential. And what is the expectation there is that if I have a more general model with a more general, meaning a more general V, that even for a fixed lambda, depending on where you are in the energy region, that you could have, say, when you go towards the edges of the spectrum, you could have point spectrum, and then somewhere in the bulk of the spectrum, you could have continuous spectrum. So you don't have this coexistence. The reason why you have this very special situation with the almost mature case is that there is a certain duality which goes back to Aubry. Essentially, the models H lambda and H4 over lambda are dual to each other. Where is this coming from? Well, essentially, this Aubry duality is like the Fourier transform. If I Fourier transform the model, well, then the Laplacian, so you have one below and above the diagonal, so if you take the Fourier transform of that, you get 2 times cosine, and vice versa, the cosine is going to give you half of the Laplacian. So you see immediately why somehow this lambda and this 4 over lambda models are dual. So basically, if you have localization on the physical side, well, the Fourier transform is not going to be localized, so you're going to have, you're expecting extended states, right? And so that explains you why you have this phenomenon here, and actually the results which are here are gotten by this Aubry duality from the results which are here. What is happening at lambda equals 2 is more subtle. Usually this singular continuous spectrum is the most difficult thing to establish. But in any case, that is something which has been, this almost mature is a model that has been very well studied. There was one problem that remained, is to understand the structure of the spectrum. So the conjecture was that basically the spectrum is a Cantor set. And of course, if lambda is equal to 2, you have a measure. Well, if lambda is equal to 2, it turns out that the spectrum is measure 0, so this was known. But the other cases where this Cantor structure had been established were rather extreme cases where either your rotation and your omega, your rotation vector is some kind of Liouville vector, or there had been also work for omegas with a certain behavior on the continued fraction expansion, but still relating to omegas in sets of zero measures. So that problem about the Cantor structure in general was recently solved by Puig in a rather easy. I wouldn't say the proof is certainly not. It's not because it's easy that it's trivial. It's not really proof. But in any case, Puig, Jonathan Puig. I didn't say the name. So what he proved is that we have a Cantor structure for the spectrum, something which is in the slang known as the 10 Martini problem. If you go to last survey paper, apparently it's the conjecture that all the gaps exist, and basically that's what he showed. I think the problem, the Martinis were offered by Katz for solving that the gaps are open. I don't know, it's kind of a stupid name. I don't know the small story, but people refer to it as a 10-Martini problem, so which is a little bit more than the Cantor structure. This is why the only reason is why I say it is that when you could have solved the Cantor structure problem without the 10-Martini problem. For instance, in the lambda equals 2 case, it was known that the spectrum has zero measure, so it has to be needs to be a Cantor set, and that would not imply this 10-Martini problem. But this is not what I want to talk about. Although you could ask, how much does it extend to general potential? And it's reasonably robust, I believe, but it does not cover the full range of the, there is some parity issue there. What I want to focus more are techniques which are robust, because, well, the technique is robust, but the specifics of the argument for Mathieu, they are not that robust, because first there is Aubry duality, and then, so for instance, in the proof, Chytromyskaya's proof of localization for lambda larger than 2, there are some very, very special features of the cosine involved, which, for instance, would break down if you would replace cosine x by cosine x plus cosine 2x or something like that. Things which are very heavily dependent on specific degrees of trigonometric polynomials that you do not get in other kind of models. So we want to understand a little bit more the picture beyond the cosine potential. And, well, many of the things I'm going to talk to just happens to be joint work with Michael Goldstein and Willem Schlag, so I may not all the time systematically mention them, but there are some things which are with Chytromyskaya also. So the picture here with a general real analytic potential, the other thing I said is that some results are non-perturbative. For instance, this result is non-perturbative. What does it mean? Well, you have these regions, lambda bigger than 2, lambda equal to 2, lambda less than 2. So these are specific numbers. And then you have a statement which is valid for almost all omega. What you could expect is some kind, what you could have also is some kind of statement that if you want to rule out a set omega, say if you want to have the statement outside a set of omegas which is of small measure, say measure less than epsilon, then you should take the lambda, say, bigger than some lambda which is dependent on epsilon. That would be a different kind of statement, say, where the specifics of the Diophantine properties, for instance, of omega, would influence how large you have to choose the lambda in order to have the statement. So we will see results which are of that type. But here it is not. There is a specific number, bon, lambda bigger than 2, and then it's true almost everywhere. So that kind of phenomenon is valid in general in one-dimensional models, at least for the localization part. So if I have a non-constant real analytic potential on the d-dimensional torus, and d, so the dynamics is on t to the d, d equals 1 or d larger than 1, you can find a number lambda 0 of v. It only depends on the potential v, so that if lambda is bigger than lambda 0, then for almost all x omega h lambda satisfies Anderson localization, so pure point spectrum with exponentially decaying eigenfunctions. The reason I didn't want to go in the Diophantine properties of omega is simply that in this theorem I don't know how to specify the good omegas in terms of the Diophantine properties. Perhaps it can be done. It can be done in the perturbative regime, but in the non-perturbative regime I don't know how to do that. In the theorem for the almost Mathieu, you can specify good omegas in terms of good x and omega in terms of explicit conditions, which are more specific than the measure category. But I don't know to do that in the general case. In recursive scheme, well, in fact, this is non-perturbative. So, roughly speaking, yes. But there are issues which are specific measure theoretic statements with not a clear Diophantine meaning. I mean, because I use probability. I use, say, what you may call large deviation estimates, which is, roughly speaking, a probabilistic point of view in an essential way. And then it's not really clear what I'm doing there, except that it's a small measure. But since we are living in a measure space, not in a topological space, I mean, this is perfectly acceptable to make that kind of statement. So in any case, that theorem is a conjunction of two other theorems. The first theorem is a result by Michael Goldstein and myself, which tells that if you have, say, assume that you have positive Lyapunov exponents for all energies, to make it simple. Where this positive Lyapunov exponent comes from, well, for instance, in the almost mature case, for lambda bigger than 2, you have positive Lyapunov exponents using a very simple trick, which is goes back to Michel Herman, which is not, I mean, this trick is good for trigonometric polynomials. If you have more general analytic potentials, the way to get positive exponents is not that, certainly not that trivial as far as I can say. But let's assume that you have positive exponents. Now, positive Lyapunov exponents for all E, that does not yet imply that you have localized, that you have point spectrum. What it rules out is absolutely continuous spectrum. But still you need a little bit more. So the theorem with Goldstein says that if you have these positive exponents, then you're going to have Anderson localization at least for almost all X and omega. But you may have some exceptional ones where it is not true. And in fact, even for the almost mature operator, you could come up with bad omegas for which you're going to fabricate an extended state, right? But it's not going to happen in the measure category if you exclude a set of zero measure. Yes, please. Right, right, and then you have an exponential decay. Yeah. You get uniform bounds. Yeah. Of course. I mean, what you really prove is the following: you take an extended state, right, and that means that it's not growing too fast, not more than a power, and then you prove that in fact it has to decay exponentially. So it's a very strong statement. The extended states are real states, and they decay exponentially fast. That's how these proofs work. Well, now, the other issue, and this is an interesting thing, is where these exponents are coming from. So to prove the theorem, the only thing I have to prove is the following thing, is that if lambda is sufficiently big, if lambda is bigger than lambda 0 v, then I'm going to have a Lyapunov exponent which is going to be positive. And actually I have a statement there which is true in a totally uniform way. I mean, essentially this Lyapunov exponent is also going to dictate the exponential decay. I have a lower bound which is uniform for all omega and E, whether omega is rational, irrational, or whatever. Now, where is this coming from? So there is an argument. What I should say first of all is what is very essential there are techniques of subharmonicity. So these techniques of subharmonicity come in their simplest form in Herman's argument, because you take the definition, you look at the monodromy operator, you complexify the obvious way by writing cosine z is 1/2 z plus 1 over z, and essentially what you say is that the integral of the log of the norm of an analytic function is at least the log of the norm of the evaluation of the function at 0, and this gives you what you want. So this is at its simplest, and such arguments, they work for trigonometric polynomials, but they don't work if you have a more general real analytic function. So anyway, in the one-dimensional case, one can still play this kind of arguments. It's a little bit harder. This is a theorem of Soretz and Spencer. And more recently, I have proven the same thing for the d-dimensional torus, but this proof is what I would call immorally complicated, because, I mean, this happens a lot, but at least to me. But in the at the bottom of the story is that you have an estimate there which is totally uniform in both omega and E. So you don't care about the diophantine properties of omega. But nevertheless, at least for me, to prove that statement in a higher dimensional case, I have to go through all the diophantine scenarios of a multi-frequency vector. So you can, take the first, the second, etc., coordinate, and you have different possible scenarios, and somehow you have to go through all the scenarios. So you have to. I don't think you have to, but what I am doing is a very detailed analysis based on the diophantine properties of omega, although at the end I have a statement which is totally uniform. So I don't have to convince you that this is rather complicated. And it's also quite different from the type of arguments involved in Hermann or in Sir Spencer, where it's just subharmonicity and basically you don't care about what are the specific arithmetic properties of omega. So it would be very nice to have such a proof in the higher dimensional case. The reason why such a proof is not so easy to work out is that somehow in the one frequency case, the complexification allows you roughly to you do a complexification and then roughly you manage to stay away from the zero sets of your potential. And this is a game which works well for functions of one complex variable, but if you have more variables, you cannot in general play this game. So that simple argument doesn't seem to work. So the message is that it would be nice to have a simple proof of that. Then there is another question which is interesting, which is the following. Assume that I don't have a real analytic potential. This is the only comment I'm going to make for non-analytic potential. Assume that you only have a Gevrey potential, some kind of thing like that. Even one-dimensional, would you still have a Sir-Spencer phenomenon? So in other words, if I take my lambda sufficiently big, you will have a uniform bound of the Lyapunov exponent from below. So this is another question, definitely, which is a non-trivial question. You could think that it's wrong, but it's not obviously wrong. And that definitely would be quite interesting. What? Here, take Gevrey instead of real analytic. Is it important? Yeah. Is it? No, but if lambda is getting big. No, but I put my factor. No, but lambda is. It's not important. So the case of the almost Mathieu is extremely well understood. All these proofs are based on subharmonicity. I also use subharmonicity, so how do I get subharmonic functions? I cannot get subharmonic. I could get it from approximation. Now, in all this game, approximation by trigonometric polynomials works fairly well, at least if you are in a Gevrey class or some kind of thing like that, but not here. I cannot get positivity of the exponents just by approximating. This is the only place. There is an observation. Well, it's not totally trivial. In the almost Mathieu case, one has a precise formula, in fact, for the Lyapunov exponent. What I told you, what Hermann tells you, is that the Lyapunov exponent is at least the logarithm of lambda over 2, but actually it's equality. The Lyapunov exponent is the maximum of 0 on the log of lambda over 2. If omega is an irrational, and if the energy, if you have an energy which is in the spectrum. Now, all these theorems about positivity of the Lyapunov exponent, they really go through the same scheme, is that you try to approximate the Lyapunov exponent with Lyapunov exponents which are defined on some finite scale. So I could introduce a notion of L sub n e, where L sub n e would be defined from the transfer matrix at stage n, so L sub n e would be 1 over n, the integral of the logarithm of the norm of Nn. And then what you try to do is to approximate Le by ln e. Now, of course, ln e has obvious continuity property. So what you get, and apparently this is an issue also, are continuity properties, and even more than that, for the Lyapunov exponent L of e. So in particular, what you can prove is that if I fix you omega, whether it's rational or not, your Lyapunov exponent is going to be a continuous function of the energy. Again, for d equals 1, in this generality, it's a small paper I have with Svetlana, but for d larger than 1, basically it appears as a consequence of this method, and somehow there the proof is significantly more complicated. Now, you can also ask for joint continuity. Now, joint continuity in the frequency vector omega and in E is not true, but it is true if you assume that omega is an irrational, or more generally, n omega 0. I mean, irrational in the generalized sense if you are in a multi-frequency case. If you have a rational omega 0, it is not true, and this you can already see in the case of the almost Mathieu, because the formula which you have here is not true if omega is rational. If omega is rational, then there is an explicit formula which gives you, I forgot the name, Karpovsk, remember the name, which is different from the result which is there. Now, you can always approximate an irrational omega, a rational omega by irrational omegas, for which, and take corresponding approximations of the energy, because the spectra are going to be closed. So for your irrational omegas, you're going to have that. But at the end, for the rational frequency omega, the formula for the Lyapunov exponent is a different formula. So you don't have continuity when you are at a rational point of omega, at a rational value of omega. Okay. Now, this is the story for AC spectrums, for point spectrum. So you have a non-perturbative result. In the one-dimensional lattice case, you have a non-perturbative result as well for the one frequency as for the multi-frequency situation. Now, with AC spectrum, the situation is a little bit different. So the tool to get AC spectrum is kind of playing the Aubry duality game. The Aubry duality extends beyond the almost Mathieu, of course. What you get, this is some joint paper with Jutomiskaya, is basically the counterpart, namely that if you have a real analytic V, and you're taking lambda sufficiently small, and that sufficiently small is only dependent on your potential V, then your operator is going to have pure, absolutely continuous spectrum. It's a non-perturbative statement because the lambda of V is not dependent on the quality of the Diophantine approximations of omega. So how does it work? Essentially, you pass to Fourier transform, you do Aubry duality. So your Laplacian is going to become a cosine, right? And the potential V, well, because it's not a cosine, it's not going to become the Laplacian, but it's going to give you a Taplitz operator. Now you can say this is bad news, because if you have a Taplitz operator sitting there, you don't have the transfer matrix anymore. But it just happens to be possible to do basically the same kind of analysis also there, where you work with determinants and you estimate determinants in an explicit way. And essentially, the non-perturbative localization theorem goes through if you replace the Laplacian by fast decaying Taplitz operator, but with a proof which is slightly different. So when you have to control your Green's functions, in order to express determinants using the transfer matrix Mn, the standard way, I didn't tell you how to do that, but that can be done. You can express determinants using these Mn's. What you do is to calculate, try to estimate directly these determinants. And again, the techniques of subharmonicity are quite essential. Now, the result which is there is for one frequency. And what is kind of interesting is that you would expect the same for multi-frequencies, But there is something something funny happening there. First of all, if you take the point is that if you look at your Brie duality, what happens with the one-dimensional model in a multi-frequency case is that you're going to have, for the dual model, you're going to have something which is on a higher dimensional lattice. It's not on a one-dimensional lattice anymore. In any case, what is true, this is a perturbative result, is that if you choose your lambda sufficiently small, depending on the potential and also on an epsilon, you're going to have absolutely continuous spectrum for all omegas which are chosen outside a small exceptional set depending on epsilon. So in other words, if I want to exceptional set of measure less than epsilon. So if I want to exclude, to be able to have the statement excluding a set omega, an exceptional set of measure less than epsilon, I will have to choose a lambda which is less than some lambda 1 that will also depend on epsilon. So question is whether this is necessary or not, and the answer is that it is yes, because there is the following phenomenon. Assume that I give you a trigonometric polynomial on the two-dimensional torus, so I have two frequencies there, that has a non-degenerate maximum. This polynomial can be extremely small. No matter what, I can always find a set omega of positive measure so that your operator V n omega 1 n omega 2 plus Laplacian is going to have some point spectrum, and in fact which closure has positive measure and with exponentially localized state. So you have a situation there of mixed spectrum. In fact, you're going to have some point spectrum at the edge of the spectrum, and then in the bulk of the spectrum you're going to have absolutely continuous spectrum. So you don't have the situation of a single spectral type, you have a mixture of different spectral types there. It also shows that when you are in a multi-frequency case, the result about AC spectrum has to be a perturbative statement. In other words, it's not enough to have a lambda just small dependent on the potential, because you still may have a certain small set of frequencies for which you get some point spectrum. No, this is all the statements are proofs, proven statements. Well, you can make an example.
You can make an example.
So since there are examples, it happens most of the time, I would expect. I mean, at least once, but still in a set of positive measure. That has not been fully exploited. I should mention also the works of Klopp, which are based on renormalization, where such phenomena are established in the continuum. I believe it's in the continuum model. But in fact, the techniques which are involved here are considerably more elementary, they are quite elementary. What it implies is that if you are on a higher dimensional lattice, you are not going to have non-perturbative localization, because this would be the dual statement of it. So in terms of state of the art, this is about as much as we have today, unless I'm not aware of some more recent works. This is the two-dimensional lattice. So apparently it's not physically the most important thing, and there is relatively little literature about it, but mathematically this analysis has been quite enriching, and say for our understanding here, technologically speaking, there has been quite a significant progress. The statement is the following. So we have a potential which is again given by evaluating your potential on the orbit of the shift. So now we are considering an orbit which is indexed by Z2, and the shift is a two-frequency shift on the two-dimensional torus. So we have a Schrödinger operator on Z2. The Laplacian is the usual lattice Laplacian. And what is the statement? It's a perturbative localization theorem under quite general assumptions on the potential. What I will assume is that I have a potential V which is real analytic on T2, which is not only non-constant, but I assume that the partial maps when you fix the first or the second variable are also non-constant. And then the statement is that for all epsilon, there is a lambda zero, which is dependent on V, on the potential and also on epsilon, so that for lambda bigger than lambda zero and omega outside a set omega of measure less than epsilon, lambda V N1 omega 1 N2 omega 2 plus Laplacian satisfies Anderson localization. Now, by the phenomenon which I mentioned to you here, you cannot expect there to have a non-perturbative result because that would rule out this kind of feature. If V would be sufficient, if you put a parameter here that's sufficiently small, that would rule out the possibility of having such a set omega for which you have exponentially localized states, of course. Because these exponentially localized states are going to give you extended states there. And, well, if you have localization, you don't have these extended states. So that is quite a satisfactory picture. There are, of course, some questions that remain. For some reason, it's not clear how to handle the three-dimensional lattice case. The reason is that there is a certain initial restriction in the omega parameter set, which is quite essential, which is an arithmetic, a deterministic restriction, and that is the only point which is not clear how to do if you have a multi-frequency situation. Now, I'm not going to get more technical than that. Let me just give you the flavor of this kind of restrictions. This is an arithmetical condition which is different from the usual Diophantine conditions. It's a nonlinear condition on the frequency vector. So what I'm saying is that there is a certain set omega n, so I will take a big n, right? And then I can throw out from my frequency set, say, 0, 1 square, a set I can take a set omega n, which complement is going to be quite small, say, exponent minus square root log n or something like that. And so what is the statement about omega n? If I choose an omega in omega n, and I look at the orbit n1 omega 1, n2 omega 2, and those n's, so I have two parameters there. I have n1 and I have n2, which are both ranging from 1 up to n. So the set of n1 and n2's which I have here is really a set of size n squared. Now I'm looking. And this is a general, this is a statement that holds in a certain generality. I will describe you right away. I'm looking at the n's so that n1 omega 1, n2 omega 2 is in the set S mod 1. Now, S is assumed to be a semi-algebraic set, so semi-algebraic set of a degree B that could be rather large. So you would take, for instance, an algebraic curve of a degree which is B. B is relatively large, but, I take an algebraic curve. You could take also a neighborhood of this algebraic curve. So in any case, what are the assumptions on the measure of the set S? What I will assume is that if I look at the sections, the best is to make a drawing of that. So this is T2. So I have, say, an algebraic curve, and then I have a neighborhood of this. This is the way to see it. I have a neighborhood of this algebraic curve, which is of size eta. And then the set S is this particular neighborhood. So what are the assumptions? Well, basically, the the eta is very small compared with n. So log n is much smaller than log 1 over eta. And then the logarithm of b is much less than the logarithm of n. And then you want to see, if you consider this orbit, n1 omega 1, n2 omega 2, for how many values of n you are falling inside this neighborhood of the set S. And the statement is that you can bound that by n at the power 1 minus some fixed absolute constant C. Now, notice that the set omega n which you have in that statement is independent of S, right? You first get the set omega n, and that statement is true for all sets S which are of that form. Now, this is the only place where the two-dimensional lattice and the two-dimensional picture comes in. And if we could have the same or a similar statement in the three-dimensional case, then we would have the analog in V3. So question is how to generalize. So this is some kind of a basic abstraction there, how to get around this difficulty. Well, either that property is not true. Well, if it is true, then fine, you prove it and you get the argument. Or that is false. If that is false, then the set omega n will depend on the particular set S, which will complicate the matters quite a bit in the argument. So this is perhaps arithmetically the most interesting thing, is that you have this new restriction of your frequency vectors, which are of a non-Diophantine, in fact a non-linear, if you look at the argument, a non-linear nature. There are other interesting aspects in this proof, and one of these aspects, for instance, is the use of semi-algebraic sets instead of eigenvalue parametrizations, which is a much more effective and, I would say, much simpler tool than having to deal with the usual eigenvalue parametrization arguments, like in the works of Sinaia or Frohlich Spencer. Also the use of subharmonicity methods in the perturbative regime, something that you may call a matrix-valued version of Cartan's theorem, that you try to control the Green's functions of holomorphic matrix-valued functions under certain reasonable assumptions. These are all issues which appear essentially in that particular model. You see, in terms of singular sites, the number of singular sites you have here is tremendous because it is of almost of size n. If it would be of size n, there would be no hope because you could have a path which really goes through the whole matrix because it's the matrix is it's a size n matrix. So this is really the minimal assumption you need to hope to be able to do something. But then to do it, you need to have tools which are quite different from those that were conventionally used, which were traditionally used in earlier works. Yes? Like what? Right. Yeah, in fact, I can tell you, in fact, B equals 1 is the most relevant case, because when things go wrong, in for algebraic curves, it always goes wrong. Usually, so it's lines. So what you have to exclude are certain very flat triangles. You want to exclude the presence, because after all, it's not just a line. You would have a neighborhood, and then you have to start looking at kind of, if you have too many points there, then you get too many triangles, and these triangles have to be extremely flat because eta is small. So the flatness of such a triangle is expressed in terms of determinants. So this is why the condition is going to be nonlinear. That's about what this proof is about. But B equals 1 is the extreme case. This is the one that you have to watch out for. Well, this is about... yes, please. I can put it back for you. Let me see. Yes. Right. Yeah.
Periodic structure is not so clear where the coordinates line, but you have various choices. The conditional depends on that choice.
On the choice of what?
The
Well, no, but you start with a V, which is your V is a function T2, so you have an you have a real analytic function on T2. So you mean you could do a coordinate change, what take an SL2Z matrix, or I mean, yeah. No, it's a good point. Actually, never crossed my mind. You're right. I mean. No, but you can do an SL2Z change of your lattice, right? And then you can instead of you would look at it like this basically. So why not? Never crossed my mind. Actually, we were quite happy to have a condition which was a realistic condition and which is usually satisfied. So I'll give you an answer to that. But I only have a few. What? How many? 5 minutes? 1 minute? 2 minutes? Just want to tell you, I started a little late. Anyway, if you got enough from it, you have to tell me. This is basically the story I wanted to tell you for the shift. There are interesting instances where the dynamics is not the shift, but some generalized shift, a skew shift dynamic, or some higher extension of it. The instance of the skew shift dynamics, well, I don't have much time, so essentially the comparison with the usual shift, well, a skew shift is still not a strongly mixing dynamics. It's not something you can compare with a period doubling map 2 to the n or something like that. So one can ask, okay, what is going to happen with the issues of localization? Is it going to be more like the shift, or is it going to be more like the random model? And understanding there is certainly very, very far from complete. Basically, the conjecture is that in the case of the skew shift, because you have a system which is mildly mixing, and also apparently there is some numerical evidence, one would expect that when you would, for instance, replace in the almost Mathieu the shift by a skew shift, and you would consider a model like the one in that theorem with cosine nn minus 1 over 2 omega, the conjecture is that no matter how small is lambda, we should have Anderson localization. But this is very far from established, and essentially what is known now is that basically, again, if you take the lambda sufficiently large and it's a perturbative result, you're going to have Anderson localization, although you would expect that it should be true for, I mean, one could expect the thing to be true for all lambda, also for small lambda. And dislike in the case of the almost Mathieu, there are also phenomena that distinguishes the skew shift from the shift. For instance, at least what can be shown is that if lambda is small, no matter how small, you still can find a set omega of frequencies of positive measure for which that H is going to have some point spectrum. This is a phenomenon which is different from the almost Mathieu case, because in almost Mathieu, if lambda is less than 2, then for almost all omega, the spectrum is going to be absolutely continuous, purely absolutely continuous. While here, you will have, at least for omegas in a small set of positive measures, you're going to have some spectrum, which is point spectrum. So there are distinctions, but this is something which is quite far from understood. There is, from the PD point of view, a natural application of this skew shift dynamics, and I'm going to stop here unless people really want to have more, which is the model of the quantum kicked rotor. So here we are in the ball game of a time periodic linear Schrödinger equation, except that it is one of a very specific form, where your potential is given by a sequence of periodic kicks in time. So, unlike what I mentioned to you last time, we are now looking at a potential which is discontinuous in time because you have a Dirac there at values of time which are integers. Now, this model basically was introduced by a number of people, Shirikov, etc., and it appears, roughly speaking, as a quantum as the quantum version of the usual standard of the usual classical standard map. Now, the standard map, of course, is a notoriously hard problem. I don't have time to discuss that here, about which not too much is presently understood. Like it often happens, if you pass to the quantum version, things become considerably easier. Also, in terms of phenomenon, things are quite different because passing to the quantum model is going to create you something with an almost periodic behavior. So in the case of the standard map, one expects, say, at least positive exponents and at least in some parts of phase space, and also some kind of chaotic behavior. There is the quantum suppression of the chaotic diffusion, and the conjecture is that there is a parameter here, kappa. No matter what is kappa, there is, say, for typical for typical values of your parameters A and B, the B is not very important, it's really the A which is important. So for all kappa and for typical A and B, this equation is going to have solutions which are almost periodic in time, which equivalently means that if you consider the corresponding monodromy operator, which is in that case a composition of two unitary operators, one unitary operator comes from the PDE here, which is an unimodular multiplication in Fourier space. The other unitary operator, the W, is a unimodular multiplication in physical space. So you have the composition of these two operators, which are, of course, not non-commuting. And, well, it's a unitary operator. It's not a self-adjoint operator, which is not so important. The issue, basically, to prove that is to establish localization and dynamical localization. Like I said, in most of the cases, when you get localization, you get dynamical localization. And that implies, that is going to imply this almost periodicity. Now, what is the situation? Well, at the present time, there is a result. I mean, there are sequence of results, but there is, in particular, a result which is still unpublished, which is some joint work with Zhitomirskaya, and it is a non-perturbative result. It will tell you that there is a kappa zero. There is a kappa zero, so that if I take kappa sufficiently small, less than kappa zero, well, then I'm going to have this flow, which is almost periodic in phase space, for almost all parameter values A and B. And, well, one expects that, in fact, you don't have to restrict kappa to a kappa less than kappa zero. The relation with the skew shift dynamics is totally clear because if you consider the unimodular multiplication in the Fourier space, you're going to have your expressions n square. And, well, if you look at the skew shift, say if you look at the iteration of the map xy goes to x plus y plus omega, such a skew shift is automatically going to generate you along its orbit this quadratic dependence on n. So you can reproduce this kind of potential just by having the evaluation on the orbit induced, given by a skew shift dynamics. So there are a number of questions here which are definitely unsettled, and it would be very nice to remove this restriction kappa less than kappa zero. But I think I'm kind of nearing the end of your patience, so we could conceive to stop it here and to continue next time with such unless you want to hear some more, I'm most happy to continue for another 10 minutes, but you may have reached your limit. Yes? There's something smooth, yeah. Yeah, you would have a generic. Well, what this is what they said last time, is that you can cook up examples where there's going to be diffusion. Sorry, not diffusion, where you're going to have a behavior which is not almost periodic, in the sense that, for instance, you could have growing H1 norm in time. But it's very non-generic. It's very non-generic. In other words, if I put you down your potential, and then I have the right to tune the frequency. So if I have some frequencies as parameters, for most choices of these frequencies in the measure sense, I'm going to have a flow which is going to be almost periodic. So you can make examples. I mean, this would correspond to choosing A or B in some in some specific way to create an accident somehow. But if you look at that statement, I have chosen the A outside the set of measure zero, and that basically avoids the accidents. So what I'm saying, the answer to your question is yes, generically, but you still can make examples. So let me be... Yeah, that would be true. Yeah, that would. Yeah, that's going to be true, I expect.
Because it's hard to believe that you really use the nature that you built a function.
Well, it just happens that this model has gotten lots of publicity. So, I mean, this is all there is to it. I mean, I don't care about this delta. It just happens to be that this is what people seem to care about. Let me answer your question precisely. So, let's take the Schrödinger equation plus. Say Vxt u equals 0 on the torus. So first, V is real, smooth. You can find examples where V is periodic in T. And you can even have a period in T which is not commensurable with 1, say with period in X. And in initial data, you can find also this initial data U0. So this thing is conserving the L2 norm, but you can make sure that the growth, if you look at the corresponding solution U of T, say, in H1, is going to go to infinity for T going to infinity.
What if in this statement I should put A in front of Laplace? This typical A will make it for the periodic.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. So... that is a situation where you have cooked up somehow your... basically, you have fabricated your potential and your initial data to have that particular phenomenon. But now, let's do the following. Let's put here a parameter, for instance. Let's put here a parameter lambda. So V is given, smooth, periodic, say one periodic in X and one periodic in T. Well, let's say real analytic, or let's even take a trigonometric polynomial, so I want to be absolutely sure. And let's take lambda now, which is generic. So first I give you V, and then I take a generic lambda. Then I'm pretty sure, I never really wrote down the details, is that you're going to have a flow for that equation which is going to be almost periodic in time. In other words, you will have you will not have this kind of exceptions. But still, if I give you an individual lambda, you can fabricate me one V. You can fabricate V, and in fact, you're going to fabricate not only the V, but you're going to fabricate also the U0. So to express it in your favorite language, you're going to violate your Fermi golden rule type of... you're going to create a resonance, and this resonance is going to come from the second order correction, which is a resonance between the behavior of V and the first approximations to the solution U of T, given by that equation, which of course are going to depend on the specifics of U0. So you're going to have to look you're going to have some explicit expression and you have to create a resonance there, is going to indicate at least that for a certain long time you're going to create some kind of dispersion in, well, you're going to create a growth in norm, and then you can start playing around with that and iterate that for longer and longer times. But it seems quite essential that you really cook up the things to have this kind of resonance. And in particular, if in that example, I mean, you would change a little bit your frequency here, these resonances would disappear and you wouldn't have the example anymore.